Welcome to Cattle HQ, a podcast from industry experts and progressive producers discussing cutting-edge info about the cow-calf sector to keep cattlemen and women in the know and positively affect their bottom line.
Welcome to Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension. I'm Taylor Grusing, cow-calf field specialist, and today I'm joined by co-host Robin Salverson, and today we're going to chat with a guest from SDSU Extension on campus. So our guest today is Dr. Matt Dearson. He is our SDSU Extension Risk and Business Management Specialist. So welcome, Robin and Matt.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us, Taylor, or having me as your co-host, I should say.
I say we're in three different corners of the state recording this, but that's the beauty of podcasts, right? As we can be joined all together. So our theme for today is cattle on feed report that recently came out last week. And Matt's been doing a bunch of talking at trade shows and several other webinars or Zoom events across the state recently on Cattle HQ webinar live series last week. And so we wanted to pick his brain a little bit further about these markets and also some risk management strategies. So we're going to jump right in. And the first question we have for you is, based on the most recent cattle feed report, what are some of the highlights that you think are important for us to watch as we go into 2026?
Yeah, so if we look at 26, we've got just had the February cattle on feed report. And that kind of was pretty much in line with trade expectations. So it's made it kind of a quiet report. From a market response standpoint, but it confirmed that you continue to have a smaller in total number of cattle on feed that's driven by tight U.S. Supplies or fewer feeder cattle available, but then also the continued closure of the border, lack of feeder cattle being brought in from Mexico. So it just says we're going to have this tight supply continue for quite some time. The other neat thing in a February cattle on feed report, you get a snapshot of inventories by capacity or by size of feedlots. So the other big takeaway I saw in the February report was you get to see the snapshot of fewer turns by feedlots, both small feedlots and large feedlots. And that's consistent with cattle feeders keeping cattle on feed for a longer period of time. So it's confirms that trend that's been happening anyway.
Thank you, Matt. So you just mentioned that as a highlight of the cattle on feed report that the inventory is still low, as you mentioned. However, the cattle dressed weight has increased. So has that increase in the cattle dressed weight offset the decrease in the cattle numbers?
Yeah, so my answer is partially. So the higher weights that have occurred, and that's partially because relatively more steers and heifers are being slaughtered compared to cows and things of that nature. So the mix matters a little bit, but the increase in weights has not been enough to offset the relative decrease in numbers slaughtered. So the net effect on pounds produced or supply, you're still not, it's not enough to move the needle on supply. So the weights aren't doing enough to give us more production.
So to kind of go along with that, we get beef from lots of different sources, right? Steers, heifers, they kind of pull those numbers together. So if we hear someone talk about total feeder cattle supply outside of the feedlot, where does that number come from? What makes up that number? How is it calculated?
Yeah, so that's a cool number. I like it from for cow-calf producers and feedlots to be conscious of that number. That comes from a combination of inventory, cattle inventory report numbers, but then also it takes into account the cattle on feed mix every quarter, which comes from cattle on feed reports, and then a little bit from sort of the cumulative slaughter level, which is going to come from the livestock slaughter reports. So you kind of blend a few different sets of numbers together depending on the quarter you're talking about. But that number is available quarterly or can be estimated quarterly. The annual number, the January 1 number is the biggest, most relevant, most credible or reliable number. And that would say we just had the inventory report late January. So we know how many steers and heifers are out there, and the heifers are broken out into replacement heifers and then other heifers. It's not a replacement. It's going to be an other heifer, steers, animals weighing more than 500 pounds, and then calves. So you add those three numbers up, and those would be cattle that could go into a feedlot to be finished. And so they're not being developed, actively being developed as a replacement heifer. From that, you subtract feeder cattle on feed. So some of those steers in inventory are in feedlots. So let's back up again. Total steers, other heifers, and calves minus cattle on feed gives you feeder cattle outside of feedlots. So it's a really credible, solid number, say as of January 1, and then it has to be estimated at other times of the year because you've got the July 1 inventory levels, but on April 1st and October 1st, you're kind of estimating based on this has been the pace of, say, feedlot marketings and stuff like that, and you're keeping the calf crop size normal or steady and stuff. So you're just kind of guessing in between, but a pretty credible number, say as of January 1, and less so on July 1. And that shows you've got a little bit of an increase in the US right now, a few more cattle outside of feedlots. But that needs to be compared against a big drop in cattle on feed. So we haven't solved the supply situation. We just don't have the there's feeder cattle that can go into feedlots yet that just haven't moved into full finishing programs at this time.
So to kind of maybe because of my lack of understanding, Matt, but so there is still some supply out there that isn't really being, is it being, it's being counted for, but maybe not accounted in the feed yards. Is that, am I, or am I reading, am
Yeah.
I understanding that wrong, maybe?
This is cool. I'm maybe going to explain something about cattle to Robin. Oh, no. So put this on the calendar. How I've talked to folks about it and how it's kind of been explained back to me at from different angles. We've got more cattle that could go into feedlots, but it's been more of a reluctance on the part of feedlots to buy younger, lighter weight animals at very high prices and put them on feed for a very long time. Ties up a lot of capital. That means that, hey, for the next 6 months, you're going to be targeting marketings in September or December. And they don't want to take on that risk for that period of time. So you've seen consistent demand for heavier feeders. And those are going right to feedlots. And then you've had more sporadic demand and more sporadic placements of the lighter animals. So this last week's cattle on feed report, the placement weights showed a decrease in placements for animals weighing, say, 600 to 700 and 700 to 800 pounds compared to last year. But the same or a similar number of heavier weight feeders going into feedlots. That and feedlots are finishing to much, much higher finished weights than last year, 2 years ago, 5 years ago.
Now that what you just shared there, all of it that you shared now makes sense to me. I have
Now
to
Rob's
admit
saying she knew what you were gonna say. She just wanted to
that.
say it.
She wanted to see if I could be. I
Yeah.
see how she's playing this game now. Yeah.
Do you think, kind of along those lines, do you think we'll see some feedlots sit empty longer after they clear out this round, like still waiting? Or like what are they gonna fill up with in, you know, when are they gonna fill up with if they are empty now?
Yeah, so there would be there are cattle out there. They're more expensive if you want to think of it that way. You're coming up on the time of year where people have also been at least discussing summer grazing programs. And it's like, well, there's fewer cows, fewer beef cows to be had. We're not doing much at all in terms of expanding. So there's maybe a supply of grass out there, or at least you wouldn't, I look out my window and it's like, well,
Maybe.
yeah, it's too early to say that we're not going to have grass this summer. So I mean, you have to be thinking about what's this going to look like in 3 months. Okay, so 3 months from now, we're going to have some grass. Are we going to run some yearlings or something on grass? So that's going to be another player in the market. So that's, from the buyer standpoint, you got a couple of groups of buyers out there right now. The feedlots, are they going to sit empty? Empty means they're not doing anything to make to cover their marginal to cover their margin costs. So they're going to have a motivation to put some cattle back in there, keep going at some level, and then they're going to have to compete for those looking to run something on grass as well. So
Right. I feel like the
that's just a
competition's gonna get
different mix of
more.
things. What's
Yeah.
that?
I feel like the competition's gonna get heavier going
Yes,
into the spring.
and it could be, and something's going to give, and that could put some downward pressure on pasture rental rates, for example. And you've seen it as a lack of support under hay prices nationally. So the hay supply is not that much different than a year ago, but or 2 years ago, and the price has moderated or come down quite a bit. So all that kind of plays into what we're seeing, or what I'm seeing and hearing around the countryside from folks too.
So, this report that we've been talking about, can you give us an idea of what consumers can expect when they head to the grocery store into the retail meat case?
Yeah, there's quite a big disconnect between, say, when a cattle inventory report comes out, or when we see what's happening with feedlots and such, and what the consumer ultimately sees. So there's a timing just for the packing and processing, but the bigger disconnect comes with the retailers aren't. They're not reporting stuff the same way that say the packers have to and stuff like that. And their numbers come in quite lagged. So when I report a retail price for beef or something, it's very likely going to be say a month old. So I've got a December price right now, but I don't have a February 21st price. So there's a disconnect there. But that's not new. But that is a what's happening with, say, at the farm level, or price for a calf that you'd see at sale barn right now. That's quite removed from what the consumer's ultimately paying, and when the consumer is making their choice. So if I was going to look for what's happening at retail, you'd want to get down there and see maybe what's happening at the grocery store level locally, that kind of stuff, or be tracking immediate retail prices. And you'd have to get very granular about it. You'd have to be like, I'm tracking hamburger at this particular chain's locations, or something like that.
Sure. So it probably goes up slower and down slower
Well,
eventually.
People like to say that happens. I've actually seen a couple of there was a couple of older studies that maybe question whether that's always the case or not, that sometimes prices can fall pretty dramatically
Sure.
at the retail level as well. So
I think, did we see that in eggs, right? I feel like it
yeah,
went pretty
that's
fast.
been eggs and eggs have been my benchmark or litmus kind of other commodity to follow here, because it's easy to talk about beef, pork, and chicken. I like to, when I can, I like to pull out or find a price for fish of some kind, and then other proteins like peanut butter, for example, is fun conceptually.
Right.
Egg prices are readily available and fairly they've been fairly volatile the last few years with the avian problems. And so it's been interesting. And as the price of eggs, for example, has come down substantially or dramatically, then all of a sudden it's a viable protein alternative. So yeah, it's and the point with all that is the retail price of beef has gotten very high. So all of a sudden, that is it has it become high enough, or has it become high relative to other proteins where the consumer would really have to start looking at that at the retail price and say, hey, that's really expensive for that particular cut or type of meat, in this case beef, and maybe I need to switch, substitute away. And if enough substitute away from something, you're going to bring the price down. So keeps things from getting the markets will do a lot of not really self-correcting, but the markets will continue to work and reward things that have high prices will bring more to market, or something, if the price of something were to come down, you'd see less brought to that market.
Right. Are these reports specific to South Dakota or are they national? Obviously, there's a national cattle on feed report, but do we get that in a South Dakota level as well?
Yes and yes. There is the cattle inventory report in January does give a state level breakdown for several categories. And then in the cattle on feed reports monthly, South Dakota is a larger cattle on feed or cattle feeding state. So the feedlots with more than 1,000 head would report in the cattle on feed report. So
Okay.
I'll give you a few observations from the cattle inventory report specific to South Dakota, and then just a caveat with the cattle on feed. So the monthly cattle on feed report, when you see a South Dakota number in there, it's only going to include about half of the cattle on feed in the state, because there's smaller feedlots who that in aggregate add up to about the same number as the large feedlots have at a given point in time. So we want to keep that in mind. But for cattle inventories, that's where I looked a little bit more at, say, the number of beef cows in South Dakota. That number has continued to go down. It's followed the same pattern as the national level number of beef cows. So there's nothing unusual happening in South Dakota. We're seeing fewer beef cows nationwide and fewer beef cows in the state. In South Dakota, that would mean a sharp decline in the calf crop, except we have been increasing. One of the few places to see pretty substantial increase, both percentage and an absolute level, in the number of dairy cows or milk cows. So this year, the increase in milk cows was bigger than the decrease in dairy cows. So that's big numbers, and I think about a dairy cow or a milk cow being a bigger consumer of groceries. It's using more feed in general than a beef cow at the same time, and more likely to be using harvested feeds rather than grazing, for example, as well. So an
Sure.
increase in milk cows, I don't immediately think about pasture rental rate or grazing rates or something necessarily. They can, and the development heifers are, you'll see plenty of them out on pastures in across eastern South Dakota, for example, but they're not going to be competing for summer grass out in Robin's direction, for example. So that's another aspect to consider. So that's resulted in a small decrease in the number of or the a small decrease in the calf crop the last few years. Not tremendously so, but a small decrease. We've got the same increase in cattle on feed outside of, or sorry, we've got the same increase in feeder cattle outside of feedlots as we saw initially. So the same sort of reluctance to place those lighter animals directly into a feedlot is happening here as well. And then something that gets maybe it's not that it's harder to tease out, but the timing of it's different. South Dakota continues to have in shipments of cattle. So cattle, say calves brought in from states to the north and the west will come into South Dakota. At the same time, calves from South Dakota could get loaded and hauled to Kansas or Nebraska or something for feeding. So,
Right.
that in shipments number, it's not tiny. But it's just another sort of data point to kind of keep in mind that we are bringing cattle in as we're shipping some out.
To kind of go back a little bit to the dairy conversation we were just having on dairy cow numbers, what about the beef on dairy cross calves? And how is that maybe impacting these numbers?
That's a local phenomenon and a national phenomenon. It used to be if you just have dairy on dairy breeding, you're going to have predominantly a Holstein bull calf that will end up in a feedlot, and then it wouldn't be expected to grade at beef quality levels. As the crossbreeding has occurred and you have more beef on dairy, I think it's the direction there. Then you end up with say a half Holstein, half whatever beef animal. And then if that ends up in the feedlots, if those cattle are expected to grade of beef quality, then they're going to show up in the cattle on feed statistics and they'll end up in the slaughter numbers and everything else. So it's not like they're being excluded or singled out or something here. So they are showing up in they're in the data, they're in the, they always would have been in the slaughter statistics or something anyway. And in the past, it would have, yeah. So it isn't fundamentally changing the absolute numbers or inventory levels that we're seeing. If you work off a calf crop, they would have been in that calf crop number before and still are. It's just maybe a little bit of the language and such in terms of cattle on feed statistics. But at the end of the day, if it's grading more like a beef animal, you're doing a sort of a for that share that's being done that way, you're giving a little bit of a higher quality mix in terms of the pounds of beef produced. So that's where I would expect to see it, is maybe in some of the, in aggregate, it would show up in some of the choice select spreads, percent primes, and some of the other values there. And that's been a topic of conversation, that and the overall tendency for these slaughter weights. The market's rewarding you right now for pounds. So quality kind of takes a back seat to can we have X number of pounds available for the consumer? So.
Marble pretty well, or they will grade fairly well, I think. But the isn't it like the carcass or like bone to meat ratio is kind of different as well, so that the total yield or dressing percentage is not as high.
So then you've got this trade-off. You've produced, on one hand, you've produced more pounds. On the other hand, it's more pound of animal and not as big of an increase in pounds of meat or carcass, depending on where you're drawing the line to do that measuring. So nationally, so I mean, if you think about percentages, that's why in South Dakota, if you just isolated South Dakota, there's 10 times as many beef cows as dairy cows. So then you're not going to, you can adjust the dairy beef cross mix all day, and you're not going to do much to impact the aggregate amount of pounds produced by South Dakota. But you're
Sure.
hearing it nationally, so then you'd want to scale that number up nationally and see. But you, it's it hasn't been enough to say, hey, this makes up for a much smaller beef herd out there.
Right.
It didn't
Which
break
makes
the
sense.
cattle cycle or disrupt the cattle cycle. You're tweaking the cattle cycle much like harvesting animals that weigh 1600 pounds versus 1400 pounds. 2000 or sorry, 200 extra pounds on 20 million feedlot cattle in a year, that adds up. So, it's ways to think about those numbers. And feedlots and cattle producers are just doing, they're responding to the market. The market's saying, we want more beef. Get us more beef. We can get you more beef. So that's the market working.
That kind of leads into really the kind of the next question is on price volatility. Do you so what kind of price volatility do you expect on feeder and fat cattle during this next quarter?
Yeah, given the high absolute price levels, if you look at the futures market, you haven't been able to get prices at these levels at this time of year ever. So for both fed cattle or live cattle and feeder weights, calf prices are at the highest level ever for this time of year as well. So it's like, okay, with record high prices, I would expect record high volatility levels too, or riskiness out there. And that hasn't really been the case. The volatility has been fairly constrained or subdued or something. That means that these high prices, the expectation is that these would continue or to be fairly stable at these higher levels rather than a huge swing further higher or lower. So I'm kind of the trade is saying, or the trade expectation is for modest levels of volatility. And I think that's probably understating the different types of risks that are out there, from pushback from the consumer because of high retail prices. At some point, I would expect that things will be mitigated with the feeder cattle imports and the New World screwworm concerns, ongoing concerns. But if those get mitigated, that would add to short run price movements and volatility. So, just the messiness that is the weather we've seen all winter from all four corners. So extremely wet in, say, California, and extremely dry from the Sierra Nevadas until you get to the maybe the Mississippi River or something, or the Missouri, the southern part of the Missouri River, and then it's wet and cold and all the way to Pennsylvania, New York. So a lot of stuff messing with another atypical weather year across the United States.
Yeah, our beef industry is really dependent upon our national internet, and it's not really a question, but just a comment, both national, international type of things happening. So, it's just that's the nature of the beef industry. That's just what it is. So
Yeah,
that
they're
leaves.
predicting the cattle market's about like predicting the weather. Maybe
Yeah.
a little bit more consistent, but like
Yeah,
I feel
I think I'd rather try to do the weather.
like can we giving the meteorologists a run for their money? Even
So
like locally,
it's
they'll feel
tricky,
like,
but
one sale barn will be good, and one local weather channel, they'll be good. But like same thing, sale barns, across the state have so much volatility. So, do you feel like people can, I don't want to say change their marketing plans this year or anything like that?
I mean, I think I would, in general, I'd continue to be optimistic. The market's shown that the consumer will absorb at least some beef at higher price levels. The pork side of things hasn't expanded greatly, so I don't see a flood of competing product coming in that way. Some paychecks are higher around the country, so some increase in labor wage rates is letting some consumers buy more products than others, and the same around the globe. I mean, some economies globally are doing better than others. So there's some good things. I certainly see calf prices being supported strictly from we can't if you found some way to snap your fingers and all the cows have twins this year, sure, you've added to the cattle supply overnight. Come up with feed for that too. But that, so that's not likely to happen. So you're going to have a constrained calf crop the next few years. So I would be, if I'm a cow calf producer, I'm generally and genuinely optimistic about prices, say the next few years. When you get into something specific like a feedlot with a 3 month turnover, that's shorter period of time with higher risk and higher stakes. They're spending huge dollars for that finished or that feeder weight animal they're putting in, thousands of dollars to get that input there, and that's higher risk. I don't think you'd need to do anything, fundamentally. Nothing is fundamentally different than it was 2 years ago or 5 years ago. We're in the cattle cycle. You might want to do some, always have some protection in place at some level, knock out the most extremes, and then you're playing a thinner margin game the further up the food chain or supply chain you go. So the feedlot's got smaller margins and more risk than other sectors. You could lump summer people running yearlings on grass in the summer, put them in the same situation. It's like that's a narrow
Sure.
window of things. It's a narrow time frame. There's going to be more risk there. You'll want to, but you know that already. So you'll just want to get that minimal amount of protection in place, probably, and leave some upside open, probably. And if in the meantime, a wider profit margin, a bigger profit margin presents itself, then you could take advantage of it. So that's how I would sort of continue to operate or think about that space. So that means things like buying some minimal put option protection or livestock risk protection, no matter what. And then if and when a better opportunity presents itself, forward contract or forward price using futures or something like that, and maybe leave some upside open all the time in case you get a repeat of 2025 and things go crazy all year long. And the best thing you could do is just hang on one more week, one more day, one more week, one more day. So, yeah.
Hope isn't a good marketing plan, though. I've
No, that's why you want to have those other things in place.
heard that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, so you kind of touched on our next segment we're going to go into a little bit, and Robin, jump in here wherever you want. But can you explain a little bit more about livestock risk protection, maybe how it started, and how it's changed or over the last couple of years?
Yeah, so it's gotten to the point with cattle audiences that I kind of take general knowledge about livestock risk protection or LRP. I kind of take it for granted. I'm assuming they've at least heard about it, if not had to sit through some excruciating insurance details about it. But it is price insurance, and a lot of South Dakota producers have purchased it. More so in the last, say, 5 years than in the previous 10, 15, however long it's been going now. It's been on quite some time. And the big thing that's happened in the last few years is they greatly increased the subsidy rate on it. So it used to pay, the premium was slightly subsidized by the federal government, and it would make it about a wash or about equal to what you'd pay using a commodity broker and say buying a put option. So you're
Really?
buying protection against really low prices, and that's all you're getting with LRP. So it's not protecting against death, loss, and some of the things that you think about with insurance. So strictly prices and cash prices. So it's tied to eventual cash prices observed in the market. And because of that subsidy being higher in the last few years, it went from sort of being something that locally was still attractive to cow-calf producers in particular. The key selling feature or thing that made it unique was that you could cover, and you can cover any number of head. So I'm a younger producer. I own 50% of 60 cows with my dad or my mom or my grandma, and I want to insure my share, so I have a calf crop of 27 head. Oh, that's not enough to be able to pencil out or make a put option on a calf crop to cover 100 head in a lump. It doesn't work that way. So LRP was always attractive for the cow calf producer and attractive for smaller producers or people with a smaller share. So it was always that way. It still is. And then, but that subsidy increase in recent years makes it just very cost effective to get a low level of coverage for very little money. An at the money put might cost $7, $8 a hundredweight. And if 50% of that is subsidized by the federal government, now your cost is $3 or $4 a hundredweight. So same level of coverage at half the cost. That's attractive. And it makes it hard to makes it hard for a commodity broker to make a good sales pitch to say, hey, buy a put option instead. It's tough. And then so that's led to a lot more use of it. And the drawbacks to it, these aren't really drawbacks, they're more limitations. The shortest duration that you can buy LRP for, or the shortest period of time, is 13 weeks. So once you're in the 13-week window, or you're only 8 weeks from when you're going to actually sell in the cash market, you can't go out and buy more LRP coverage. So you can't upscale or lift up or roll your coverage to a higher level like you can with put options. So it's not the, it's just a limitation. But there's nothing stopping a producer from using a broker and buying a put option at a higher level or doing a futures or a direct sale and getting a higher price level locked in after the LRP window has kind of expired or passed. So there's some things that you can do in the short run that would complement somebody who just said, hey, I'm going to get that in place. I get it now at this level and it's there. I'm protected against a huge move in the market. Then the market goes the other way, and you've got some other steps you can take to better position yourself and take advantage of higher prices if they were to materialize or come around.
So for them to look at LRP or to get LRP, they talk to an insurance agent versus a commodity broker because it's an insurance,
Yes,
basically.
so LRP is an insurance agent, an insurance product. And that's where there are a handful of insurance agents who have added brokerage lines and brokers that have added insurance lines. So you might be able to deal with the same company or group and get both. But oftentimes, you're also as likely to see them separate. So then you just want to be, it falls ultimately on the producer. They're the ones with the risk. So they want to do what's best for their operation. They might be dealing with a couple of different entities to make that happen, but it's no different than dealing with a couple of different bankers, lenders, or a couple of different you might be very, very consistent delivering your cattle, using the same auction site, but sometimes you might use a different auction site, or some of the time, or depending on the cattle, or a different one for when you're a buyer versus when you're a seller. So, you know, again, you might go north to find some calves, and you might look south to sell your calves or something like that.
You really need a team of individuals to help you manage that risk when it's all said and done, whether it's insurance, whether it's a commodity broker, whether it's your individual helping you rep your cattle to wherever, you know, they're being sold and XYZ. So there is definitely takes a team of people, but it is the responsibility on behalf of the cow calf or whoever owns the cattle to take that initiative and do that. So.
And that's nothing that the, you know, the it's not outside of the scope that the cattle producers got to deal with. So with so many things, so yeah, it's just one more. It's maybe one more thing to pile on or layer on there, but it also means that you've got a valuable commodity that you're working hard to protect, or working hard to maintain. So there's at least at this time, you've got that positive benefit of we're talking about making sure you're getting high prices. So that softens that the cost side of it, because the benefits are so good at the moment.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to compare it to like corn and bean insurance, right? Like, so when I'm asking, like, so when corn and beans got high, did people consider not taking, you know, that price protection insurance on those versus I feel like the cattle guys now, you know, are open to a little bit more risk when the price is high. And, you know, they, 'cause this, I don't want to feel like it's a newer product, but it's not just a steady, oh, I always buy insurance on corn and beans, but I don't always buy insurance on my
Yeah.
feeder cattle.
And you should be a little more particular with livestock insurance and pricing, because it's strictly on prices. So with crop insurance, you're dealing with revenue protection, and here it's strictly price protection. So you do want to think about it differently than you would crop insurance. Now, at the same time, with a heavily subsidized product like LRP would be today, you do want to think about, a minimal amount of coverage over time would absolutely pay off. So you don't want to go all in and buy a high level of coverage one year and then ignore it the next year and flip-flop back and forth. That probably wouldn't be the best strategy to pursue. Pasture PRF, pasture rangeland forage insurance would be like that as well. It's subsidized, but you want to get in there, take advantage of a subsidized product, but have some level of coverage in place year after year after year. So you don't have to always buy LRP on calves at the same time or whatever, but you'd say, hey, I'm probably going to buy some, and I want to get it before it's too late too. So I'm looking for some combination of a rally in prices, or set yourself a deadline, write it in your herd book. You know, hey, by June 15th, I'm gonna have at least gone in, bought some minimal amount of coverage, and spent very little on it to be protected against a surprise or a wreck. And then I can adjust upward as better opportunities arise.
Sure. Yeah. So along those lines, from a price a basis, let's talk about basis, for example. So how do producers figure out what their local basis is? How do they use that to figure out the value of their animals?
Yeah. So in general, we talk about basis on cattle. We're talking about the difference between a cash price, that could be a statewide average price, or a price for a specific spot, minus usually a nearby futures price. So if I'm talking about the basis on fed cattle, I've got a price series I've put together from the AMS that's out of the Sioux Falls Regional Livestock location. So that's a price for slaughter steers from Worthing, South Dakota, and the futures price is it's It's one of the delivery locations, so that would be part of the collective that the futures price represents. So
Sure.
that's what I use there. Then on feeder cattle and calves, various South Dakota sale barns have an AMS price reporter, so you've got readily available, publicly reported prices across weights and grades. Typically, you're looking at large number one steers for the benchmark price. That tends to be the largest volume of heads sold that category. So that's what we kind of track and back out. So that comes up with a cash price for 7 to 9 weight steers and a cash price for 5 to 6 weight steers are the two benchmarks we follow on campus and such. And then, so those are going to give you benchmark levels to use. So if I'm going to have 800 pound steers in September, typically I would know what that price difference is between South Dakota prices, cash prices, and the futures price, which would be the September feeder cattle futures price on the exchange. So we have those two averages. It gives us an average, it gives us a basis level every month. And then for fed cattle and feeder cattle, a 5-year average by month is a pretty reasonable estimation or approximation. So I can expect feeder cattle to be $7 higher in South Dakota than on the board, say during May or during September. And that 5-year average is pretty good for feeders and fats. And then on calves, or 5 to 6 weights, for example, you don't want to use that 5-year average anymore because prices for feeder cattle have gotten so high, and prices for corn and hay, key inputs, have also fluctuated a lot. So that basis that you would, a 5-year average of basis wouldn't reflect the current or recent basis levels that producers have seen the last, really the last year and a half on 500 to 600 pound calves. So that's been running more like $125 100 weight here the last year and a half. So
Okay.
that's probably something where you definitely want to look at recent basis levels for planning purposes there, rather than relying on some kind of 5-year average in that case, just because those underlying components of that have changed so dramatically in recent years.
Okay.
To me, I think a basis is a great way, even if they never choose to use any type of options or even LRP or whatever that type of risk management tool is. To me, if they understand what their basis is, at least that gives them a better understanding of what their potential end price is. I mean, it's not perfect, it's not exact, but it will help them allow them to
It's a
identify, maybe
general,
I need to.
general planning. Yep.
Yeah, but it good, but again, not that they shouldn't try or include these risk management tools into their marketing strategies. If needed, they should. But I just think I remember as a kid, my dad would listen faithfully, to the market reports and talk about basis all the time. And at that time of my life, I was like, I don't care, Dad. But it's, I have to, as you've gotten older and have more stake in the game. That basis does make sense. My brother talks about it all the time, more on the cropping side of it, but it's a big deal. So,
And
yeah.
right now, if I'm a cow calf producer, I'm already thinking about it for what basis to think about for this fall. If I'm looking at yearlings, I've got two basis numbers running through my head. It's what basis would I expect to see, so I can figure out what's a fair price to pay for a calf to run on grass this summer. And then I'm also thinking about what kind of basis to expect when it comes off grass in September, October. So you kind of need, behind the scenes, you're running with those numbers in some way, shape, or form as buyer or seller or both. So, yeah.
And
Back to
where
that
do you
one.
find those
Sorry.
numbers if you're not tracking them yourself? Where could you find those?
So currently I have on the Extension SD State EDU website, I've got an article there about live cattle basis, so that's where that one's at. You'd have to today you'd have to send me an email to get my back files of feeder and calf basis levels. Had been putting the historics up there, but I'm tweaking those this year in part to discourage the use of the 5-year average on calves, just because I figured it would send such a mixed or send the wrong signal about what to do or use with that. So, but
Okay.
we would have that basis available if you wanted it, to wanted to see the historic. We're not trying to keep it to ourselves. We're trying to find a better way to get it out there on the internet with for informed consumption. So, just haven't gotten the feeder one done yet, and haven't been in a huge hurry to do the calf one until that's most appropriate for this fall. So.
Yeah, so you can do as like research, but make sure it's good research to find levels that are accurate. I know we had to redo some of our budgets too because just the template values in there were, way
Yeah.
lower compared to what they are today. And so, if anyone is looking for those type of things, they can just reach out to you or reach out to any of us at extension.sdstate.edu to find some of those if you're looking.
And we have some additional tables nationally and some other states and stuff too, readily available to us or for sharing and such too, through the Livestock Market Information Center or the LMIC. So that they would have more, it's nice. Hey, I'm thinking of sending my cattle down to, not that anyone would do this, send the cattle to Kansas or something. You can see basis levels down there. It'd be good for comparison, too, to say, hey, the quality premium for, cattle should be this compared when I see a price out of a different state or a different location. So,
Okay.
we can get folks access to the, LMIC information if they would like.
I do have one more question for you. Not that we always interview extension folks, but I'm newly back to extension. So I like to ask folks like you, Matt, what is your favorite part of extension?
Oh, I think it's the fact that every day is different. You don't know what the market's going to do, what the international trade issue is going to be. And so every day is different, and it's fun being on both the sharing things with producer audiences, extension audiences is a lot of fun, but hearing the questions and concerns from those audiences is every bit as rewarding as me having the privilege of sharing some research or ideas or things from the university. It's hearing what the issues are and visiting with the producers and citizens of South Dakota. Just makes it cool.
Right. Yeah, like you said, you hear it from them and you go meet them where they're at. So I know you do a lot of winter meetings and traveling. And so people like to pick your brain as well as much as you like to hear, what their thoughts are. So
Oh, hearing what's going on is fun. And I think it makes us better. It sure improves my scholarship, my academic work too, because it's like you've got a better appreciation of what the real concerns and challenges are, and hopefully it means better research answers on the other side as well.
Right. Well, that's a good way to end our episode. Like Matt said, we like hearing from you. And so if you don't have our contact information, you can find us all at extension.scstate.edu. In the About tab, our experts page has all of us, as well as many other state and field specialists at your ready, I guess. Wherever you're listening from, you can call us, email us. We'll be there for you. So with that, this has been Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef cattle. Visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information, and until our next episode, eat beef.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. we invite you to visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information, as well as subscribe to the show on Spotify. You will also find show notes and resources from today's episode. Until next time, remember, success is not a goal, it's a byproduct.